If this book were a murder ballad, which one would it be?
Well, musically, I think it might be The Long Black Veil. Sense of humor-wise, Delia's Gone, maybe. I love murder ballads. I used to teach them when I taught high school. That was my way to get kids into poetry, or get into ballads anyway. Yeah. And I think in those terms, I tend to be sort of a romantic and depressive at the same time.
They go together.
Yeah, so I have a strong affinity for murder ballads.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Bruce Hulbert about his haunting novel, Whiskey, which has been called merciful and merciless, true to life and hallucinatory, philosophical and thrilling. Don't go away. This book is called A Powerful Multi-Generational Tale about one rough and tumble family from Central Washington State. It's about the scars people inflict on one another and about the many tragedies and occasional moments of grace. Why did you need to write this book?
It's funny, the idea of needing to write or being compelled is works maybe differently for me than for other writers. I just follow my nose.
Yeah.
And whatever I happen upon and get interested in, like I was really interested in the voice of how these characters talk to each other. And so I just started following them into situations that either other people had used that I admired or that seemed natural. The first one is the boys driving around looking for a place to bury their mother.
Yeah.
I would say what compelled me was the characters kept coming back. It was originally a group of stories.
Uh-huh. I want to get to the dialogue later in the interview because I found that compelling as well. But will you begin by describing these boys, these brothers, Andre and Smoker?
Well, Andre and Smoker are brothers from a pretty dysfunctional marriage. Their mom is a force of nature. And doesn't back off from anything. She is the opposite of overprotective. Mm-hmm. She is more likely to abandon her kids than worry about him. Although she does care about him in a weird, weird way. and they all care about each other in a weird, weird way. But Andre and Smoker is this perfect fit for his world. He's good looking, has a good rap, knows the sort of detachment necessary to make himself inviting to women. Mm-hmm. And he's also doesn't have the sensitivity, doesn't have much sensitivity past that.
Yeah.
He tends to be, his mother describes him, says the women think he's a heart wrapped in leather. And they, you know, everyone figures they're the one who will get to the heart. Mm-hmm. And really, he's just leather.
Yeah.
And Andre, on the other hand, is sensitive, and that works against him in his world. It isolates him and drives him to be an alcoholic. And he's the one character who seems to be sort of trying to make sense of the everything around him because it doesn't, you know, he's unhappy with it. It doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Smoker is completely content, except Andre isn't. And there's mm-hmm. enough between them that they continue to sort of try to solve each other's problems in ways that are disastrous most of the time.
I agree. I was wondering if you would begin by reading a short section on Andre.
Sure. Andre recounted at high school when he calculated others' needs and responded, never considering his own. He appeared unselfish, but such a demeanor swapped honest selfishness for a dishonest brand. Andre manufactured a self others found amicable by winnowing out most everything in him that wasn't. It made tolerating him easy and knowing him impossible. He'd left no room to love or hate him. His generosity was never as natural as Smoker's self-interest, and he appeared disingenuous at best. Once in high school, he had scored 18 points in a basketball playoff, yet near the game's end, stood at the free throw line, certain he would miss. In the second before he directed the shot forward and watched it careen off the rim, everything came clear, and he understood that he'd arrived at the boundary of himself and would progress no farther.
In a Spokesman newspaper article, you were quoted as saying, "Andre, he comes to you out of your fears, and Smoker comes more out of who you wish you were."
Yeah, at certain points. I mean, Certainly Smoker, I wish I had the ease with people, especially with women, that Smoker does. I've been married for 32 years now, so I don't miss that as much as maybe I did, in my single days. But yeah, there's an ease and a comfort in his interactions with the world. And some of it has to do with ideas about manhood. Mm-hmm. Smoker fits the bill, and Andre doesn't. Because he worries and because he's sensitive. He knows it. He recognizes that he doesn't fit, that he's isolated. And so I suppose that's my fear. I grew up in a place where folks don't say much. Mm-hmm. And I never could be myself because I like to talk, or in this case, write. Mm-hmm. And if you talk very much, they think you're a lawyer, and then it's all over. Or you're identified as feminine.
Yeah.
And either one, I had to sort of swallow a lot of myself, I think, in order to fit that definition. And I never fit it well.
I'm also thinking that I'm a pretty sensitive reader, and I wasn't sure I could stomach all the gore and the violence. But the thing that steadied me, Bruce, was the dialogue and these lyrical phrases. So I wanted to ask you, where does the lyricism come from in you?
Well, I think my language in general comes from home. That same sort of distrust of verbosity and the unwillingness to talk directly about a thing.
Yeah.
My language is invested with that. And it's invested in it to the point where it affects the grammar.
Yeah.
It affects the syntax of sentences. Mm-hmm. I go home and I listen to people talk, and there are sort of grammatical structures that they never, ever use. And so I borrowed that sort of, it's a sort of an effort to truncate the language. And one of the results is that it's funny.
Yeah.
Because people who are talking in those blunt of expressions, oftentimes they're poking at each other. And that's how most people talk that I grew up with anyway, is, especially men, that's what they do is, they jab one another.
The dialogue is so good. One of my favorite lines comes from Smoker, of course. "Animal ain't ever been as alive as when it's dying." And I wanted to know, what's your advice to writers about dialogue then?
Oh, I would say don't ever talk about the subject at hand. Listen to people. And this is, again, my son went to school in Boston, and he tells me it's different in the East. but in the West, people don't talk about what they're really, what they're really confronting. They talk around it. And I think that makes for interesting tension. And I think that paying attention to those things and paying attention to rhythm. I'm a big one for sound.
Yeah.
The sound in my ear is what matters to me. And also the sound, when I read someone else's work, the first thing that attracts me is the sound. Mm-hmm. If there's a sound there that I can say, oh, okay.
Yeah, you can get on board.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to get away with not talking about violence.
Okay.
So it's a theme in your work. And in Whiskey, there's a scene where Andre and Smoker are fighting and a bystander approaches them with a flashlight and a gun and says, I ain't inclined to intrude in others' personal business. Just don't believe anyone ought to force themselves on the other. Which, again, I thought was a lovely piece of dialogue. And throughout the book, I felt like I was that person, that bystander who like had stumbled upon the scene and I was bearing witness to it. And I also felt like I had to protest somehow what was happening in this book. Is that what you intended to evoke in the reader, or how would you say it?
I guess I would say no, that yeah. I'm not conscious of that. I think that even the brothers talk about that particular character later. One of them, Smoker, talks about how it's a funny story that he'll tell the rest of his life. And Andre says, no, he's going to feel stupid because he walked up on us thinking one thing and then finding out something else was going on, which is, typical of how they both would respond to something like that. I think this book is more emotionally violent than it is, than it is bloody. And I think that violence is a significant and powerful part of being in the human experience. There's a reason why people put, why the police put yellow tape around a burning house. It's not to keep the people in the house out or in. It's to keep other people out because they're fascinated by it. People drive by car wrecks over and over because they're fascinated by it. Sporting events, all kinds of stuff. Violence is sort of the last force that nature possesses the upper hand in. Mm-hmm. And even human, even people being violent to one another, it's as if this natural force takes them over, unless they're psychopaths. Mm-hmm. And so they get overwhelmed by it. And I can't see any way not to talk about that. Cormac McCarthy described it in a way that I think is gorgeous. He said, life is the flower that feeds on flesh. And I just don't see that as a part of the world that, especially my world, the world that I'm writing about, it's inherent in everything people do. And I don't apologize for it because I'd have to apologize for everything I do. I just think it's a very powerful force. And I also think that the difference between seeing somebody slip on the ice and laughing and then finding out they've broken their arm is razor thin. Mm-hmm. And that's a place I want to spend time. I'm interested in that place. And, you say portions of this book are funny. Well, that's why. They're funny because they're on the edge of violence.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Bruce Hulbert about his novel, Whiskey. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the next segment, I'll get personal with Bruce about his own history of violence and its aftermath, what he calls stunned silence. This conversation contains mature themes. Listener discretion is advised. Preparing for this interview, I did some reading and research, and I'm aware that there's some violence in your own family history.
Yep.
Are you willing to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. My grandfather was murdered by my great-grandfather when my dad was like nine months old, I think. And so my dad was raised by country music and hard work. And as a result, when it came time for him to raise kids, he was a wonderful, attentive father, but, you know, you could sense a sort of moments of doubt in him. In fact, it's, you know, usually he's a pretty comfortable person, but there were moments where you could see he was trying to work it out. Mm-hmm. And then I was involved in a shooting with one of my best friends and my roommate in college. He was working for doing an internship for the Okanagan County Police, and he offered me the gun that he was using, and I mishandled it, and you know, and it killed. So, in a way, that kind of, not at the time, but later, I recognized a sort of circle that it made with my dad and myself.
What was the circle?
Well, I think it was the relationship to sudden violent possibilities and the sort of stunned quality that goes with it. You're stunned the rest of your life. My dad's mom never talked about it. And he is finally now, he started talking to me about it after she died. And he finally is going to see old cousins and friends of his and collecting information about, in part about that, and trying to figure out a way to get comfortable or more comfortable with it. Because for him, the stunned silence was the silence of growing up in a house where, you know, nobody really talked and everybody was broken. And for me, it was more being the one who did the breaking.
I have to tell you that I looked up images of you online, and the pictures are so imposing of you, you in like a oilcloth duster jacket with a shotgun. And then I read the New York Times piece where you beautifully describe this incident, and any anticipatory fear just melted.
Those pictures, my French publisher, I sent him, you know, stuff, sort of publicity stuff, and he kept saying, send us a picture. And I said, I sent you pictures. He said, no, in France, we want you to look like your characters. And that was for the book Lonesome Animals, which is a very bloody book.
Yeah.
And so my son and I, we just went out in a field behind the house, and I said, okay, I got to look mean. So I put on the duster, and he took some pictures of me. And Oliver was happy. He, do you know Pete Fromm?
Oh, yeah.
He told Pete he couldn't come back to France because he shaved his mustache.
Yeah, right. It's an infamous mustache,
yes.
Right? I'm aware now, mm-hmm. sitting with you, that you've been a high school teacher for 30 years. And
yep.
That's so present in your demeanor. And one of the things you and I were talking about before the interview was the use of narrative, both as kind of a therapeutic approach, but as a teaching tool. And I'm wondering, I have two questions. The first is, how did you teach the Andres and smokers of your classrooms? And how would you incorporate, you know, a narrative therapeutic approach to them?
Well, I would say, I guess I would have to talk about my teaching history a little bit. I started just like a deer in the headlights. And then, like most teachers, I sort of came up with a scattering of things that worked, and then you sort of create a philosophy from there. And at first, I was all about discipline and high standards and those kinds of things. And I still value those things, but I taught in a small school in farm country. And most of those kids were college bound, and so holding them to those standards was something they were familiar with. And when I moved to the city, I found the population was different. And one of the things that I seem to have a capacity to do is sort of morph into where I think there's a hole, where I think there's an empty place. And I started with teaching the AP classes, which I enjoyed, but a counselor approached me and, I was a principal, and said, "Hey, we got a bunch of kids that the only class they're passing is yours. I wish we could set up a haven for those kids, but we need at least two more of you." And I said, "Well, why don't you just give the AP classes to somebody else?" And they said, "Well, you'd be okay with that?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, I was toward the end of my career. And, you know, one of the things about teaching is you never want to get too comfortable."
Right.
Because you tend to get lazy. And so I ended up with all the kids who either nobody else wanted or who had really struggled. So I got a lot of Andres and smokers. And to tell you the truth, those kids are more intellectually engaged than most of the middle kids are. The middle kids, they just want you to tell them the right answer so they can bring it back and deliver it on a test. Mm-hmm. These kids want to know why in the hell they have to take a test, mm-hmm. and why any of this matters. And approaching them was required a kind of personal investment that, that I grew comfortable with. I would say they liked philosophy, mm-hmm. Because they felt like they were living philosophy. You know, when we'd talk about Hobbes and Locke and, the nature of man, and they'd say, "Yeah, in the lunch line today."
And we're in it.
So they like that stuff, and they're also deeply interested in things being fair and justice and that kind of stuff, which is why they're in trouble, because schools often aren't interested in fairness as much as they are in being a smooth-running machine. And I would say they're also deeply interested in story. Some of them are trying to be stories. You know, they're living out other people's stories, or stories that they've inherited from their own family. Some kids don't like school because their parents didn't. And so they show up looking for a reason to feel bad about school. And, school provides one, and that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So allowing those kids their own stories, which is one of the things that we've really... The teaching of writing is the tail wagging the dog. We can't teach kids to write well, or it's very difficult and requires a lot of time. And the other thing is, it's hard to justify. It's hard to say to parents, "Well, this kid's paper is better than this kid's paper," because sometimes you can't quantify the difference. You recognize it, but you can't score it like a math paper. And so what schools have done is come up with a way to teach kids how to write mediocre prose and mediocre paragraphs because they can score it. And so kids don't write stories anymore. I tried to sort of bridge the gap between that by saying, "Okay, if we need to have a thesis statement, why don't you figure out a story you want to tell? And then we'll come up with a thesis statement later. We'll come up with something that suits the story," mm-hmm. rather than you spit back to me three paragraphs of drivel that allow me to check off a box on a rubric. I think that one of the things I like about narrative therapy is that it allows kids to act past the thing they write. So that the idea is, in generally, and I only know a general part of it, is that once you write your story and once you tell it, then with a little distance, you look at it and you determine whether you like it. Is this a story I want to be in? Mm-hmm. And if not, what parts might be getting in the way? What characters or what behavior by you? Mm-hmm. And it's a way for kids to examine that stuff and ask those questions that adults are always asking them, which they immediately flip the switch. So I would say that was a very rewarding. It was very revealing, the length to the kids would go to expose themselves.
Mm-hmm. What's the story you want to be in?
Me? I don't know. You know, I think to a large part I'm in it, but I spend a lot of time getting out of it. I would say much of my adult life has been involved with me correcting a whole bunch of misinterpretation of my life as a child and trying to remake it so my kids don't have to face that same thing. One of the things that I, you know, you grow up and in the house I grew up in, I felt like everything was my fault because there was lots of noise and lots of tension. And so I sat down with my kids and I said, okay, 90% of the time I get mad, it's because I'm being a jerk. And 10%, it might have something to do with you. So don't own the 90% because it doesn't do you any good, and it doesn't do me any good, and it makes me sad. And the other 10%, if you want to talk about it, come, we'll talk about it. But, you know, don't pack that 90% around, because I did.
Though he lived in 23 towns before the age of 6, Bruce Hulbert claims Grand Coulee, Washington as home. He lives near Spokane, where he was a high school teacher for 30 years. Look for more information about his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.